Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. We'll take one nun, turn her into an archaeologist, add storytelling talent, and what do you get? Compelling books. My guest today, N.L. Holmes, is author of a series of three immersive historical fiction books that unravel the mysteries of life during the ancient Egyptian Empire: Flowers of Evil, Web of Evil, and Wheel of Evil. They're available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about N.L. Holmes, go to nlholmes.com. And you can follow her on Facebook, LinkedIn, and X. And Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about your background, because I mentioned it in the beginning. You went from being a nun to an archaeologist to a writer of not just this series, but other series as well. And we can talk about that as well. But just give our viewers and listeners a sense of your background.
Well, I was born and grew up in Texas and Fort Worth, the friendly city where the West begins. I was converted to Catholicism in my teens, and I entered the convent at the age of 21. I stayed there for 20 years, doing nunny things, including artwork. I designed stained glass for the monastery. When I got out, I went back to school to pursue archaeology, which had been my childhood intention all along. So I got back on that track and got my PhD from Bryn Mawr College, and in the meantime, got married to one of my fellow students, and we have a son. I have been teaching history and humanities since then, with brief time spent as an interior decorator and as the administrative assistant of an educational foundation. So I've had a kind of varied career, you might say.
Like it. It's eclectic.
Yes, eclectic.
The last thing you have to do is just become a hired assassin. I think it will work out very well.
Yeah, that would help in writing these novels.
So how did you end up picking this period of time for your latest series of historical fiction? The Egyptians, that whole history of Egypt is interesting to a lot of people, but what clearly struck a bell with you, given your background?
Well, my actual field of expertise is not Egypt, so, you know, I have to warn people that while I am an archaeologist, I'm not an Egyptologist. So I started out writing about the Hittite Empire, and in particular Syria. And then I realized that there were only about five people in the world who cared about the Hittites. And so I thought, well, I've taught a class in Egypt that was very well received. People enjoyed it a lot. So I decided to shift my gears into Egyptian. And so I've done two series there. This latest series is a spinoff of the first one, the Lord Hani Mysteries.
Well, when you decided to, as you mentioned, you're not an Egyptologist, but still it's under the umbrella of archaeology in a way.
Yeah.
So that works out too. I'm just fascinated too by the fact that you grew up in Fort Worth and somehow ended up at Bryn Mawr. And then from there.
Yes, that was my good luck.
Or some people would say, oh, maybe you should have been the other way around, starting in Texas. I don't know. Who knows? But at any rate, when you start to write, and I know that this is different for authors of fiction versus nonfiction. Both entail some research, clearly, if you're writing historical fiction. But at the same time, you have a certain leeway, a certain liberty that a lot of nonfiction writers don't have. And so would you agree in terms of just being able to write?
Yes and no. I mean, I've sort of set myself the limit that I wouldn't contradict anything we knew to be true. So, or if I did, for whatever reason, and I think I've done that once in 14 books, I'd tell the readers, and you know, in my historical preface, so they wouldn't be misled. But by and large, anything we don't know, and that's most things, the daily life things, and the personality of people involved in the past, then the novelist is free to embroider and to make things up, which is kind of fun. You try to do something that's plausible, or, you know, if you're creating a personality for a king who is known only by doing X and Y, then you try to think of what sort of person would do the X and Y. So it's, you know, it's a mixture of the research and the rigor of nonfiction writing and imagination, which is the base of fiction, of course.
Sure. When you decided to write, and again, it's Flowers of Evil, Web of Evil, and Wheel of Evil. A lot of evil in all of this, but you're...
Yeah, they're mysteries.
Right. So, is there something in your research that, given it's the Egyptian background that you're writing about, is there anything, instead of new under the sun, is there anything new under the pharaohs in that sense, that are under the pyramids, that you introduce in your series that people may be surprised by?
Well, this series doesn't have much political intrigue as the previous series did. So there are probably no new facts you're going to learn, but I have taken it with each book. I take a different profession and the mystery centers on somebody of that profession. So, you know, in a way you learn a little something about daily life and that sort of thing. The first one, Flowers of Evil, it's a florist for the Temple of Amun-Ra who is murdered. And the second one, it's a weaver. And the third one, has to do with chariot making. So, you know, that's kind of the gimmick on this series.
Is there an arc to the three book series from your point of view?
There is not in the series. There definitely was in the series from which these have spun off. Mm-hmm. But this is pretty much just separate adventures, which, you know, you don't have to have read the previous ones to jump in. You can jump in at any spot. They're more like, I don't know, Agatha Christie, in that you can read any one of them first. The same people recur in all of them. And there are certain things that are referenced maybe from one book to another, but you don't have to know that to follow the story.
You could start with Wheel of Evil and then end up with Powers of Evil.
Just as easily.
Gotcha, yeah. So it's self-contained in that sense.
They are, yes.
Isn't there a challenge when you're writing a mystery from that far back in time? And the tools that exist to unravel the mystery are a little bit different than they are today.
Yeah, there's no forensic science, you know, there's nothing, no fingerprints, nothing. And actually, that works in my favor because I don't know anything about forensic science. So, you know, rather than have to research police procedure or something like that, I guess I, as a fairly well-educated modern person, know as much about Egyptian-level forensics as anybody.
So you really have to be creative in the sense of how do you solve a crime when you don't?
Yeah, well, it's pretty much like your traditional Poirot or, you know, Sherlock Holmes. It's just people asking questions, finding witnesses, looking for clues that are physical and visible.
Well, in the two examples you gave, though, those were not modern society, but there was at least a hint of development. Whether it was cars or even horse and buggies versus in that time. Do you take into account the culture of Egypt in the crime-solving part of it?
I try to a lot, and that sort of works with the idea of taking a profession. I mean, what is the social status of these people, you know, and how would they have lived? If, say, an aristocrat murdered a commoner, would he even be prosecuted? These are just, you know, sort of little things, and we don't necessarily know the answer. But you have to think about that in order to construct a believable world.
Right, in a society that has a certain caste or class.
Yeah, well, very hierarchical.
So the upper one could do something to the lower one and get away with it, perhaps, versus the other way around.
And they actually understood the soul as being sort of different for each level of person. Gods had one kind of soul, and king had another, and, you know, grandees had another, and a commoner would have a different kind of soul. So what is that soul worth in terms of punishment? I don't know. Worth thinking about.
When you wrote each book, because it's fiction versus nonfiction, do you still share it with someone to give you feedback before you go to press with it?
I do actually. I pay to have it edited, and that involves a beta reading. Who, and my content editor happens to have a disabled child, who, so she was a good sensitivity reader for one of the books. I don't pass it by a colleague for the scholarship, because I think it's probably not that important. The average reader is reading it for the story, and mm-hmm. you know, I avoid saying anything I just know nothing about it, unless I warn the readers in advance. So I don't think you'll be grossly misled, but there's a lot I don't know about, certainly. And
maybe know about it. Yeah, I mentioned this in the beginning, and you just mentioned it now, and it struck a chord with me in the sense that, given your background, where along that line from nun to archaeologist to writer did you find you had that storytelling ability?
Well, I come from a family that appreciated books. I mean, it was a very bookish bunch. My aunt was the book editor of the local newspaper, and my father wrote stories for Boys Life and things like that. So it never seemed unreasonable or impossible that I should write. And my cousin, who is also a published author, and I used to spend rainy afternoons sitting down with a pad of paper writing novels. And sometimes, you know, one even got finished. So it was always there. I just didn't have the time to do anything about it.
Yeah, but eventually you did get to that stage, and you've been prolific yeah. ever since, which is great.
After I retired from teaching, however, it didn't Understood. Happen simultaneously.
But what's nice about that, though, is you retired, as you said, from teaching, but the fact that you were then able to turn slightly and start this other career.
Yeah, and I'll tell you one of the motivations.
Yes, please. No, that's right. Please do, because I was going to say.
I was going to say one of the motivations was I just wanted an excuse to keep doing research.
No, that's good, because a lot of people retire, whether it's from teaching or something else. It's not that they get lazy, but you get used to not having to get up at the same time every morning and drive somewhere to work, et cetera. And so you obviously continued on. And as you just said, it's because of your love of research. That's a great way to keep you motivated.
Yeah.
I asked you earlier about whether you shared it with people to read. Do you share it also with family before it again reaches that stage where you're publishing it?
No. I mean, when I first started writing, I passed one of my manuscripts through my cousin, who, as I say, was also a writer. But other than that, it's pretty private. I mean, it is by its nature a very sort of solitary activity, and that suits me okay. So, you know, my husband reads them after they're published, but he doesn't read the manuscripts.
When he reads, this is a touchy question, when he reads the published book, not the manuscript, does he occasionally find a typo and then point it out to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's happened. Yeah. So even the editors can miss something occasionally.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, you can't blame it on the author, because there are proofreaders and there's copy editors and everything.
Goes through four or five hands at least.
Yeah, exactly right. Yes, I just found a typo on an author or guest book, and I haven't had a chance to let him know yet, but it's just so that he can change it for the next edition.
Yeah.
That happens. Do you see your work, especially, again, I want to always mention the names of the book, the series, Flowers of Evil, Web of Evil, and Wheel of Evil. And do you see these at some point adapted for a potential either television show or film?
Well, I don't, just because I don't have a television, so I don't, you know, but readers have said that they think this series would make a good television series, because it has sort of, you know, strong characters that recur with every episode. And, you know, you could have a mystery of the day. At this point, there are only three books, but there's one coming out in February or March. So they will multiply pretty rapidly. I think it would be fun. I don't know if the production values would have to be too expensive for something that's set in a, you know, a place like ancient Egypt. You'd have to do green screen, I guess.
Either that or use the old Cleopatra set from the 60s.
Yeah, maybe.
Taylor. So, do you want to mention the name of the new one coming out in February? You're more than
Yeah, it's The Melody of Evil.
Okay, Melody of Evil.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned you don't have a television, which is unusual for most people in society today.
Yeah.
But you do have a computer and you do have a phone, so you're still in the 21st century. But
oh, yeah.
You really don't need a television, you just need an agent.
Yeah, I need somebody to do all the things that that an author is expected to do for herself these days. It's
I know.
It's no longer the way it used to be.
No, it's totally different. I know. Exactly. When you wrote the three, did you always have the three books in mind for the series, or did you start to write one? And then it just, you said yourself halfway through, you know what, I have an idea for the second one. And then during that one, you said, you know what, I think I could do a third one.
Well, I kind of had an idea that this was going to be a series because of the involvement of different careers, for example. And also the first series, the Lord Hani Mysteries, bridged a particular time in history from the coming to the throne of Akhenaten, Pharaoh Akhenaten, till the time his son Tutankhamun comes to the throne. So there's a certain number of years that pass and certain things happen in that period of time. But this one, the cases occur every couple of months. And so Nefert and her gang can keep solving mysteries for 50 years if I live so long. You know, it's something that sort of lends itself well to an unbounded series, just however many I want to write.
Well, maybe they build one set for this TV series.
It's all taking place in the same spot. So.
Right, so you can amortize the set over X number of books and stories.
Yeah.
It's a great idea.
Of course, the problem is when you pitch these to production companies, they always want you to suggest actors to take the roles, and I don't know any modern actors. I hardly ever see movies, so...
Well, I go back to my suggestion, get the agent to do that. You know, you have a book agent, let him work on that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not a book at that point, but that's okay. In your description earlier, you said that your readers note the strong characters and that some of them, obviously, as you mentioned again, too, that they're returning characters or recurring characters. Could you give us a sense of some of the characters and how they interact with each other, regardless of whether it's book one, book two, book three?
Sure. The main protagonist is a 25-year-old woman named Nefert. She's the daughter of Lord Hani, who was the protagonist of the previous series. He is a diplomat, Egyptian diplomat, a real person, actually. Nefert is fictional. She is what we would call a lesbian today. She has a partner who is her fellow physician. The two of them are women physicians, which was unusual, but not unheard of. And to sort of cover up their relationship, Nefert is married to a friend of her father's, an extremely rich man who is now the treasurer of the kingdom. And so she and her father shares in their adventures because he has contacts in the greater world. And sometimes people won't listen to women when they're asking questions. They require a man being there. So he comes in. So there are the two women doctors who have an apprentice, a girl apprentice, who is one of a group of orphans that they adopted. Her father was murdered, and she and her brother and younger brothers and sisters were adopted. So the three young women are the main detectives with Nefert's father, Lord Hani, and her husband, Thomas, is sort of a cryptic character. He's extremely rich, good looking. He married her with the understanding it would be a white marriage because his previous wife had died, also been murdered, and he was seeking a shelter from all the women who were seeking his hand in marriage. So it's a complicated relationship.
You mentioned the wider world and having that father figure fit in or serve in that capacity to ask questions, etc. How wide of a world was it then in terms of how they got around, how they traveled, how they communicated? There were no phones.
Well, travel was slow. And that's something that's, it's not so obvious in this book, these books, which are set in the city of Thebes, or Wasit, as they called it. But in the Hani Mysteries, he is, being a diplomat, spent a lot of his time overseas in what is now Syria or Palestine. And so there was a lot of traveling going on, and of course by boat for the most part. And even within Egypt, travel was by boat. So, I mean, I find that boat business, where it's sort of like going to Venice, you know, it's, they hop on a boat and go, or the police come in a boat. It's it's really a unique part of their culture that's been fun to deal with.
And in the approach to crime and the solving of crime, these protagonists use what kinds of techniques or what kinds of resources, or to give us a sense of some of them, that how would, other than asking questions, I know you mentioned that earlier, asked a lot of questions, which really is the basis of a good investigation, but there must be some other elements to it, even in a society that goes back so far.
Well, the book I'm working on now, for example, deals with the poisoning, and the fact that their doctors gives them a way to sort of figure out through the symptoms what poison was used, and therefore might give them a clue as to who had access to that, you know. So the Egyptian doctors were extremely advanced for their time in many ways, although we primitive by our standards, but
sure,
they had been working on this for thousands of years, just trial and error, but they wrote down what they found. And so successive generations had case books that gave them an array of symptoms, and then, you know, you can treat this, or no point even trying, and gave them a sense of what it might be caused by. So it was pretty sophisticated for its time. They were known, and that means they were scientists of a sort. They experimented, they wrote down the results and learned from that. So I think, in retrospect, it was a good move to have her be a doctor, even though this was inherited from the previous series.
When they solve the mystery, and we won't give too much away because obviously we want people to read the books. When they solve the mysteries, is there justice? Is there a punishment? Is there a resolution?
Yeah, that's a good question, because for the most part, there is justice. They had also a highly developed judicial system, although it wasn't, they didn't have a code of laws that, you know, were specific. It's more by custom, but they did have judges, and they had witnesses appear. They had, you could have someone represent you in court, although you could represent yourself. So that there is that mechanism, but for the most part, it was determined by class. So, as I hinted earlier, if a grandee, for example, kills a poor person, chances are he's not going to suffer any consequences. Where if it happened the other way around, he'd probably be put to death. But there too, there were relatively few capital crimes in Egypt compared to elsewhere. Things tended to be resolved with fines. And it would depend to some extent on what the family of the victim wanted to do. If they wanted your hide, probably they'd get it. But if they forgave you, you might not be punished. And so there is a case in the second book, The Web of Evil, where it's a little ambiguous what happens at the end in terms of punishment, because it was within a family. And one gets the feeling that perhaps, you know, the perpetrator, who seemed to be justified, actually might not be punished. So I'll leave it at that, so I don't give it away.
That's good. Was there a sense, though, if not necessarily justice or punishment in the sense that we think about it, was there a sense of shame once the perpetrator or perpetrators were figured out?
Yeah, there would have been. And in particular, there is a sense of sort of moral shame. They had a religion in which, in the afterworld, you were expected to make a kind of sworn statement to the gods that I didn't hurt anybody, I didn't lie, I didn't, you know, cheat widows and orphans and this sort of thing. And then you would also recount the good things you had done. And this became sort of formulaic. There were pages you could buy that would say, you know, all these things you did or didn't do. I guess you just checked the boxes on the ones that applied.
Fill in your name.
But, yeah, exactly. But so, I mean, there was definitely a sense of shame associated with some things. And it was a rather subtle moral code, too. We're used to sort of Judeo-Christian rights and wrongs, and these match up pretty well.
Was there, because we talked about the class distinction, mm-hmm. was there that moral code coming into effect even if the grandee doesn't get punished because he committed?
Yeah, you kind of get the feeling that even if he's not punished on earth, the gods will see and they'll do whatever they do. So I think you'd have to be pretty hardened to commit a terrible crime in those days. Well, people did it, certainly, so I guess they were hardened.
Well, before I let you go, what do you want readers to take from reading this series of books, Flowers of Evil, Web of Evil, and Wheel of Evil?
I guess the moral I hope they take away is the same I used to wish on my students as a teacher, and that is to understand better that ancient times were pretty much like modern times in the human capacity, that people haven't really changed. Their culture may change, their worldview may change, but their emotional reaction to things is the same as ours, always been the same.
No, even if the technology changes too, it doesn't.
Yeah, because we only have so many possible emotional reactions to stimuli, and those don't change. It's biological, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been N.L. Holmes. She's author of 3 immersive historical fiction books that unravel the mysteries of life during the ancient Egyptian Empire. It's The Flowers of Evil, Web of Evil, and Wheel of Evil. They're available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about N.L. Holmes, go to nlholmes.com and follow her on Facebook, LinkedIn, and X. And Nikki, you're not related to Sherlock Holmes, are you?
Oh, I used to tell kids in school that I was descended from it.
Great. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.